keeping space clean, and developing a green thumb off-planet. You're listening to Are We There Yet?, the radio show exploring space exploration. Hi, I'm Brendan Byrne. We're tracking thousands of pieces of human-made debris that are no longer in use floating in our planet's orbit. It's estimated that there's more than 100 million more. And while there are efforts being made to try and clean it up, should there even be space junk in the first place? We'll speak with University of Texas at Austin's Moore Bajah about how we can respect space and clean up in orbit. Then, there's been a lot of research on how people adapt to space travel, but what about plants? One researcher says understanding how things like plants react in space can teach us how the human body reacts to other environments. We'll speak with the University of Florida's Rob Furl about his experiments launching plants and himself into space. That's ahead on Are We There Yet? When a satellite's mission ends, or we lose a piece of a spacecraft in space, where does it go? For the most part, debris stays close to our planets, but these human-made objects are crowding up our planet's orbit. Over 40,000 objects have been tracked, but there's estimated to be lots more than that. Over 100 million pieces of debris. So how do we clean it up? And how do we fix this? Well, here to answer those questions and provide his outlook on space debris is Moore Bajah. He's a professor of aerospace engineering and mechanics at the University of Texas, Austin, and the co-founder and chief scientist of Gaiaverse, an AI-driven intelligence decision platform. Moreba, welcome back to Are We There Yet?
Thanks a lot, brother. Great to be back.
What is the risks with space junk? Why can't we just leave all this trash up in orbit?
Just as a refresher, you know, we're tracking upwards of 50,000 objects in Earth orbit, ranging in size from cell phone to the space station. And about 10 or 11,000 of those are working satellites, and everything else is junk. And the junk is very difficult to predict where it's going to be. It's traveling at relative speeds upwards of, you know, 14, 15 times the speed of a bullet relative to things that we might care about. And they're orbiting in those places for many, many, many years, and makes it very challenging with a growing number of objects to predict where these things are going to be and what's in harm's way.
What is kind of the status quo or the norm for dealing with space junk in the here and now today?
There are two main camps. One of them is called space debris mitigation, which is trying to prevent creating more of it. And there's space debris remediation, which is cleaning up the junk. When it comes to the remediation, there's really not much that's being done. I mean, the current practice, especially in low Earth orbit, is just let your satellite run out of fuel, let the gas tank go empty, and let Mother Nature figure it out. And, you know, over a span of years, because of, you know, small particles in the upper atmosphere, eventually these orbits start decaying and, you know, will eventually burn up in the Earth's atmosphere.
When you discuss this issue, there's talk about reaching space sustainability, right? Making sure that we're taking care of this stuff out there, and it alleviates risk. But you wrote recently that sustainability amounts to, at best, a holding pattern, and at worst, an excuse. You know, why is achieving sustainability not the right thing? And what should we be setting our sights on instead?
Yeah, so I appreciate that. And I think in general, I mean, we each might think of different things when we say sustainability, but the point that I really wanted to make is that when people are talking about sustainability, many of them are just saying, hey, can we find ways to just not make things worse? And so that kind of comes with having to learn how to live in our own filthy bathwater kind of thing. It's like there's already a bunch of junk. Not making it worse is necessary. But it's insufficient, because what we need to do is we need to be restorative, we need to be regenerative, we need to be healing, we need to make the place better.
You've written a lot about this, Moreba, and in some of the writing, you mention you look towards sustainability practices of Native Americans or Hawaiians here on Earth. Is kind of the work of these groups of people shaping how you think about how we should take care of space?
For sure, I feel that the work that I'm doing is spiritually guided. So I feel spiritually inspired to do the work. And part of that spirituality means that I embrace this belief that all things are interconnected, and that our original role as a species coexisting with the rest of the planet is one of caretakers, custodians, or stewards. And so, you know, as a BIPOC, I find deep resonance with these beliefs of many indigenous people around the globe. I still have a home on Maui. And so I live on Maui, and I engage with Native Hawaiians, this idea of seeing the environment not separate from ourselves, but part of ourselves, seeing the environment as kin, looking at constituents in that environment as being sovereign, whether it's plants, animals, these sorts of things, and having a sense of not just gratitude, but respect when we utilize that environment for our own existence, that's a gift. And so approaching space in a very similar way to say, instead of looking at space as just something to dominate, something to own, something to exploit and extract from, looking at it from space is an environment that is a gift. So to me, the epitome of sustainability and let's say regeneration and restoration is the ability to gain some benefit from your environment perpetually. Anything that hinders your ability to perpetually receive and get benefits from the environment is an issue. And that's what I'm trying to make with people.
You're listening to Are We There Yet? I'm Brendan Byrne. We're speaking with Morba Jha about orbital debris and how to keep space clean. He's a professor of aerospace engineering and mechanics at the University of Texas at Austin and the co-founder and chief scientist of Gaiaverse, an AI-driven intelligence decision platform.
I really do appreciate that lens that you're looking at this issue through, that spiritual lens. But as you hinted at, there is a practicality to this as well, right? We rely on this stuff all the time. And whether or not you feel a connection to it, you still rely on the satellites that are in space. And if space debris impacts that, it goes away. Do you get frustrated by people not understanding just how incredibly damaging this problem could be, whether it is from the spiritual or the practical aspect of things?
I would say this, right? Less than 1% of all of humanity is making decisions that the rest of us have to live with. And I'm gonna say they're powerful. I'm gonna define power as the ability to make choices. So the thing is, this less than 1% of humanity is making decisions for the rest of us that we have to live with. And their behavior is one of extraction, exploitation, colonialism, you know, greed. The services that we get are beneficial. And at the same time, the way in which this is being done is 100% detrimental. So it's almost like, I don't know, the invention of plastics, man. The invention of plastic helped a lot of stuff. It helped transport all sorts of goods. It helped preserve things, minimize disease, all sorts of benefits from plastic. And yet, it's probably like 90-something percent of every single plastic that was ever created still exists today. That's bad news, man. It's like we came up with a great thing and we didn't think of the detriment that we were doing with plastics. It's something similar for space. Satellites do some really awesome and amazing things. The way in which we're designing, launching, and operating these things is long-term detrimental and will eventually, if we don't change, prevent us from being able to utilize these satellites to get internet, to get communications, to get position, navigation, and timing, to get weather warnings, and all these sorts of things.
How do we make that change? What is a way that you are proposing that we can, I'm sure, simply fix this issue, right?
Yeah, man. I mean, look, I think about this incessantly. And interestingly, I've been in groups where I've discussed this sort of thing where people have pulled me to the side and said, hey, man, the whole spiritual kumbaya, let's tickle each other and have pillow fights thing sounds nice, but the bottom line is money. How does this all tie to economics? The thing is, I can certainly say, based on our behavior today, there will come a time when we will not be able to operate satellites because they're going to get, you know, schwacked by pieces of junk and all this other stuff, and it's going to preclude our ability to utilize satellites. The first question that I get after I say such a thing is, when is that going to happen? It's like, okay, well, I can tell you with certainty it will if we don't change, but in terms of when, I'm not sure. Oh, well, could that be 5 years from now? Is it going to be tomorrow? Oh, it's probably not going to be tomorrow. Well, is it going to be within 5 years? Well, I'm not sure. Okay. So given that you're uncertain, the answer is then irrelevant. So people equate uncertainty and ambiguity with irrelevance. Because the thing is, it's like, well, I only care about what's happening in the next 3 years or whatever, right? I'm an investor. I'm a stockholder. I want ROI. Who cares what space looks like 10 years from now? I want to make my big gains, you know, 3 to 5 years. And if I can't guarantee that something cataclysmic is going to happen in 3 to 5 years, then it's like, call me back when it's really bad type thing. It's horrible, man.
You know, it always does come down to that, right? Whatever the issue is. But is there a case to be made that technology like regeneration or approaching things with a circular space economy could be beneficial economically.
When we shift and actually design satellites that are reusable and recyclable, that'll be creating jobs. It'll be creating technology that'll be useful for things that aren't specific to space. It will allow us to continue making profit from satellites in the long term, dare I say, in perpetuity. The financial gain of doing this circularity is infinite. The not doing it is certain doom. That'll happen with certainty. When? Not sure, but it will happen with certainty if we don't change. So it goes from, hey, here's this resource that we can live with and get benefits from forever, 7 generations from now, we'll keep on being able to make money, or next generation for sure won't see it.
I hate to be the pessimist here, Morba, but is it going to take one of those catastrophic events happening in there to kind of light a fire under people's behinds to get this happening? Are we going to need to see some sort of cascading or Kepler syndrome happen before we decide to, I mean, that seems to be what we do down here on Earth, right?
Yeah, man. So the interesting thing is that sort of catastrophic event stuff has already been happening. In November of 2021, Russia decided to blow up one of its own satellites in an orbit that greatly affected Starlink satellites and that sort of stuff. You know, they blew up the satellite. It created a bunch of shrapnel, and then like a month later, they went in and invaded Ukraine. It was very
put the ISS at risk, right? They had to raise the orbit.
Yeah, that too. So that's already happened. I think the Starlink satellites have already had to maneuver. It was some biblical number. It was like 144,000 times, like already in this calendar year, that Starlink satellites have had to maneuver out of the way of junk. If you have to put a satellite up and you have to move out of the way that much, then it's like the purpose for you putting the satellite, that starts to get compromised, because like then you can't deliver the internet that you want, or you can't take the image that you need at the time that you need. You can't access a certain part in orbit to see a part of the ocean or the ground or whatever, because you're farting around trying to avoid other satellites and avoid garbage. And I would say that, yeah, there are definitely orbital shells or neighborhoods or highways, as I call them, that have already been compromised in their ability to sustain free and unhindered operations. And, you know, Starlink is already experiencing that. And there's so many people that want to launch so many more satellites.
What are you hopeful about? I mean, do you see a solution to this in our lifetimes? And are there folks or organizations out there that are leading the charge that give you hope?
I do have hope. And I can tell you that by and large, the next generation people, that some of them are students that go through my classrooms and that sort of stuff, that generation that's coming into, you know, becoming professionals, they by and large get it and are waiting for us older folk to die off or retire to step in and make decisions that make sense, you know, on a planetary scale, you know, when it comes to like stewardship and custodianship. So I do have a lot of hope. I'm, let's say, impatient. I want them to grow up as soon as possible so that they can like take over this stuff, because the current adults in the room are screwing it up. I also have hope in the global South, man. They are mostly dismissed by Western society, Western civilization, and they're coming into their own in terms of being participants in orbital space. And for sure, in the conversations that I've had with people from the global South, they're a lot more connected to the environment and land and water than Western cultures are. And those beliefs and that relationship, that can be propagated into how they behave in space.
Morba Jah, thank you so much for joining us.
Aloha nui loa, my brother.
That was Morba Jah, professor of aerospace engineering and mechanics at the University of Texas at Austin. He's also the co-founder and chief scientist of Gaiaverse, an AI-driven intelligence decision platform. Still to come, understanding how we can have a green thumb off our planet.
Some of the very same gene categories that humans change in space, especially long-term space on the space station, are also activated, changed, and repressed in plants when they make the journey to space.
How one scientist is working to understand how space impacts plant life. That's ahead on Are We There Yet? You're listening to Are We There Yet?, the radio show exploring space exploration from Central Florida Public Media. I'm Brendan Byrne. One interplanetary mission may soon be coming to an end. The Juno spacecraft, which explored Jupiter and the giant planet's moons, was set to end at the end of September. While missions often get extensions, the government shutdown is making Juno's future uncertain. So what's happening with Juno? And what have we learned from the mission? We'll answer those questions and look at the history of the spacecraft next week on Are We There Yet? But for now, we're talking about gardening in space. It's more important than it might sound. If we want humans to live and work in space for longer periods of time, plants are a necessity. One scientist is working to understand how spaceflight impacts plant life, going so far as to launch himself and his plants into space. Here to talk about those experiments and research is Rob Furl, a distinguished professor of horticultural sciences and the inaugural director of the Space Institute at the University of Florida. Rob, welcome back to Are We There Yet?
Hey, thanks for having me. I certainly appreciate being here, Brendan.
It's always fun to chat with you, Rob, because you bring such really cool science experiments and research to this show. We're going to jump into your latest experiment that flew on New Shepard's NS-35 uncrewed mission. What did you send up this time? What were you looking for?
Whenever we're asked what we're looking for and what did we send up this time, it always feels like a new thing, even though it's sort of like the same old thing. We look in these flights, especially in these flights with New Shepard, at the transition of biological things from being on the Earth to being in space. In this particular case, we sent our plants, sure, but we sent new genotypes and also with some new technologies to do two things. One is to look at the metabolic gene expression profiles of plants that flew compared to those on the ground. This will be the third time that we've been able to do that. That's a scientific triplicate in our vernacular, and it means that we've had the privilege of flying this experiment three times. That means if there was a perturbation based on travel getting there and travel coming back on Delta Airlines as opposed to Blue Origin, we will have started factoring those kinds of things out and really looked at the fundamental responses of plants on their way to space. The other thing that we did is we advanced our technologies that allow us to look at, with specialized cameras that look into particular wavelengths of light, to look at signals that move in and around plants at the various parts of the flight. When they're getting ready to take off, during the high G accelerations, they send signals around the plants. They sense gravity and start sending signals that we can now visualize using the technologies that we have. So this allows us to look at both the very much real-time, second-by-second things that go on, as well as the biochemistry of once they've gone and come back.
What's fascinating to me, Rob, is, and please take no offense to this as a plant biologist, but when I think about plants, I think to very inanimate objects, right? They don't do much when I'm looking at them, right? That they take forever to grow, and in my case, die very quickly. But you're saying that there are these kind of changes that happen like second by second in these plants during spaceflight that you're able to track and measure and observe?
Yeah, absolutely. What, please appreciate, and I take no offense as somebody that works on plants, please appreciate that plants and human beings, we share 50% of our DNA sequences.
Wow.
We're built on the same fundamental mechanics of how life senses its environment and reacts to its environment and does the thing that it has to do, it being life, in order to survive and thrive. And we have such wonderful tools now, just like when you go to your doctor and leave your samples, plants leave their samples with us, and we can see deeply into their metabolism. And we can also do that with some of our specialized tools in real time. It's almost like attaching electrodes, only we do it visually, to plants to ask them what's happening during launch, entry into space, and recovery. And you got to understand, the other thing that plants have going for them, for us as scientists, is that as humans, if we get cold, we can put on a jacket. We've got behavioral things that we can do to ameliorate whatever happens to us. Plants don't have that. So they actually have to have really highly tuned responses that allow them to do different metabolisms at different points during the day, or when it gets cold, or when it rains, or when it floods. These are all things they have to do differently whilst just sitting there, as opposed to getting up and going away to a better place.
It's so interesting that you're able to see this. What are these plants telling you about what they're experiencing during spaceflight?
So one of the absolutely, I think, astounding to me and to many of us little stupid geeky people that think about stuff like this is that plants actually do know when they're in a different gravity environment. They don't do that in their little plant minds, of course. They do that in their plant cells, which, as I said, are basically designed along the same structural mechanisms that our own cells are. And so what happens is that plants sense, and in fact, the things are actually so highly tuned that We know that plants have recorded in their biology the fact that they were in the truck riding out to the launch vehicle. We've watched them settle down as they were sitting in the capsule waiting to launch for about 8 hours. And then we watch them get really excited when the high Gs kick in and the rocket takes off. And then we also watch a different set of reactions when the Gs go away and they enter into microgravity. And these we see basically because of the kind, as I mentioned earlier, the kinds of signalings, and we've equipped these plants with fluorescent molecules that we can watch move around the plants. We know that from roots, signals move up to the shoots and to the leaves during launch. Everything then settles down once they get into space, and it gets reactivated when they have to go through high Gs and return to the Earth. These are new things, and these are new reactions because as biologists, we've been able to do a lot comparing life on the space station to life on the Earth. But we've not had much opportunity to do life on the way to space or life on the way back down. And so these are kid in a candy store, brand new, let's find out what's going on kinds of things to do.
You're listening to Are We There Yet? The radio show exploring space exploration. I'm Brendan Byrne. We're speaking with Rob Furl, distinguished professor of horticultural sciences and the inaugural director of the Space Institute at the University of Florida. We are talking about his recent experiment that flew on New Shepard about how plants react to spaceflight. Rob, you mentioned that you're able to track these different times of excitement for plants, you know, on the ride to the pad, and they settle down while they're in the seat, and they get excited again once they're flying to space. You also flew on a New Shepard capsule yourself. Have you compared your heart rate data to these plants? Are you performing much like these plants are when they travel to space?
One of the things that happens in humans on the International Space Station over time is a series of reactions, a series of metabolic changes that are keyed by something that basically talks about stress inside of our mitochondria, the powerhouses of ourselves. Plants have mitochondria as well. So what we found really interesting in our plants going on New Shepard and on me going on New Shepard is some of the very same gene categories that humans change in space, especially long-term space on the space station, are also activated, changed, and repressed in plants when they make the journey into space. So when you ask the question, are there correlations between what happened to me in my flight and what happened to plants on their flight? Yes, there are. And these things are so richly informative about what happens to terrestrial biology and how we're designed to live here on the Earth compared to how we're not designed to live in space. It teaches us a lot about how biology can adapt itself and its capabilities when it moves into space.
We're all made of stardust and act like plants.
Fair enough. But we do share a certain large amount of capability and innate ways in which our cells deal with things that we're learning a lot about.
Rob, at the start of our conversation, you mentioned that you kind of hit the trifecta with this, right? You're able to get, you know, three successful experiments done, which is really great in proving a concept in science. This replication is important when it comes to experimentation. We joked at the start of our conversation about you being a frequent flyer on New Shepard, but I've got to think that having access to suborbital spaceflight has got to be able to help scientists like you to continue to get all of this great data and really prove out some of these scientific theories that you're setting out for, right?
Absolutely. And we, by far, we're not the only people on this particular flight. Each flight that we've participated in has got 20 to 30 different universities, companies, and agencies running experiments at the same time. So the amount of scientific opportunity to explore the trip up and the trip back, let alone the microgravity portions that are often celebrated in these flights, is one of the very, very big things that commercial spaceflight brought to the equation for us, giving us a platform that we can fly, rinse, repeat, fly again, make our equipment better, do our science better, make better plants for the next trip. That's unbelievably big science compared to where we were a decade ago. No question about it.
Finally, Rob, I want to ask you about kind of the practical application of this experiment. If I'm following your thinking, understanding how we transport plants and how they react to that flight into space is going to help biologists like yourself create plants that are far more sustainable for when, say, we need to grow food on the International Space Station or a moon base. Is that what this research is really leading towards? towards making plants hardier for spaceflight?
The practical engineer in me says, yeah, that's exactly right. Why waste energy on a reaction to living in space when what we really need is not that reaction, but we need better food or more vitamins or whatever it is we need? Yes, yes, yes. You're very right. I appreciate that. The scientist in me, the philosopher in me, wonders the bigger question. What do plants teach us about the terrestrial life forms that have grown, lived, and developed here? What are their limits in the universe? And if our plants can live in space or on the moon or on Mars, what does that tell us about life in the universe? That's really where my heart is.
And that's profound. I love that. Well, then what's next, Rob? What unanswered questions do you still have?
I just gave you sort of two bookends. We know a little bit about humans on the long term in space. We know a little bit about plants and long term in space, and a little bit about plants going up and down from space now that we've had suborbital flights. But there are a lot of other organisms that are important to our exploration of the universe, microbes and other things that should be tested, looked at in these same sorts of repeated ways so we understand very, very fully as we can what happens to other kinds of organisms when they make the trip. And just from a very personal perspective, during my flight, samples were taken from me in the flight and back. We need more of that kind of, not exactly replication, but the same experiment done on different genotypes of people. Different people that are taller, shorter than me, people that eat different stuff than me. And we need to know as much about biology making the trip as we can learn. We're scratching the surface and we're getting there, but there's a lot more science like that to be done.
Rob, I can't tell how tall you are, but if I meet the criteria, I'm more than happy to volunteer.
You're there then.
Sounds good. We've been speaking with Rob Furl, a distinguished professor of horticultural sciences and the inaugural director of the Space Institute at the University of Florida. Rob, the only guest on the show that we could start talking about biology and then talk about space philosophy. Always a pleasure to have you on the show, Rob.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That's going to do it for this week's show. If you're not already, be sure to subscribe to this show's podcast feed so you never miss an episode. Do that on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or really wherever you get your podcasts. Stay connected with this show. Be sure to follow us on social media. You can find us on Instagram and Facebook. We're at @AWTYSpace. And if you got an idea for a future episode of the show, or you think you might be a great guest, well, reach out to us. Our email is aretheyet@cfpublic.org. Are We There Yet is a production of Central Florida Public Media. Our intern is Orion Boone. Our producer is Marion Summerall. Editorial guidance comes from Latoya Dennis. Support for Are We There Yet comes from our listeners. Until next week, I'm Brendan Byrne. Thanks for listening.